please the seat. It. Mr. Page.
Thank you, ma'am. I thought I would deal with the VIRES issue first. My first submission on that is that the court's drafting does not contain a VIRES problem. If there were to be a VIRES issue about these conditions, it would be to the extent that a condition of consent binds a third party.
Mm.
That doesn't arise because if we look at the conditions, the sample conditions that the planners produced in their joint witness statement, the condition that is enforced is the condition that attaches to the subservient permit. And so it's the subservient permit that is enforced against that permit holder. And no objection to that can be taken from a VIRES point of view.
So the condition that is enforced is the subservient,
yes.
They're calling permit holder.
Yes.
Okay.
If it were the other way around,
then there'd be a problem.
Yes. Mm. If it was the dominant permit holder's condition that was being enforced against the subservient, then that would be ultra vires.
Yeah. Now, planners, they don't actually deal with that though in their JWS.
No, they don't address that topic.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me that the planners, either by accident or by design, they were alive to the distinction by the way that the subservient permit consent was drafted, because it seemed to me that that was the intention, that it was that one that was to be enforced. And if that was their intention in my submission, that's correct.
I think the court, I tend to agree with you. I think, and this will be a reflection of time constraints, but some of these JWSs are getting shorter and shorter, you know, and hence the court has sat there with the draft and going,
yes.
Do you know, how is this meant to work? And what are we, you know, essentially going through its own interpretation exercise because it's not a sufficient text to explain what is on their minds.
Yes, and why they arrived at what they did, yes. I understand that, but if we think about the conditions as only being enforced against that permit holder, in my submission the VIRES problem disappears.
Yep, yep, yep.
And for that reason, my submission is that it's not necessary for there to be an OGA-type mechanism in the entry condition because the consent of the permit holder isn't necessary. Mm. Now, with that in mind, I have attempted some redrafting to anchor the purpose of the condition to the circumstances of which is of concern under the Act, which is the allocative effect of the priority. And so the policy... I'm sorry, we haven't tracked these from your draft.
No, it's okay.
No, that's fine. We worked all that out ourselves.
Figured that out.
Yes. And so the change to the policy was to make clear that the sufficiency related to a higher priority permit downstream. And then the entry condition applies again where there is insufficient water passing the point of take to supply a downstream permit with a higher priority. Now, over the break, I've had a debate with my friend Mr. Moore about whether we should be expressing that in the present tense or in the past tense, that is the with a higher priority as opposed to had a higher priority. My view, which I don't think is a unanimous one, I think even between Ms. Irving and myself, is that it should be expressed in the present tense because it refers to the conditions of the permits to be issued under Plan Change 7.
Just pause here a second. I've made a note and I know what to read it with that in mind.
So you weren't proposing any definitions?
No, we'll get to that because
that might
be one way of dealing with the issue that your
colleagues are raising, that's all.
Before you move on, can I just take your explanation and then read it into what you've written here?
I do think a definition would resolve the issue, but I haven't had the time to craft one. I have crafted a different one, though, over the morning adjournment, and Rachel has very kindly typed it in. I thought it might be useful to understand what is meant by sufficient.
Yeah.
In my submission, sufficiency is simply where, one, the exercise of the permit doesn't derogate from the ability to exercise the higher priority permit.
Okay.
Now, that mightn't always be easy as a matter of evidence to prove, but that's not something that you need to worry about in the drafting, because that's the practical reality on the ground will be as it is now, which is that the higher priority permit holder will be standing on the bank of the river and observing that they can't get water, will wander upstream to the neighbour's place and find that all the water's disappearing up the neighbour's pipe, and that's how anybody will know what's going on.
Yeah, there's no mathematical precision.
No.
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 Did you need to define higher priority? Because I'm thinking you probably do. Which is, Now, again, everybody out there knows what a higher priority take means, but even so, that's a key term, higher priority, and probably, I haven't even got it in front of me now, one of the things that we thought, downstream water user, I think we said define downstream water user, we're thinking that the idea of the relationship or linkages between upstream water users and downstream water users or your higher priority would be picked up in a definition.
Yes. Mm. It struck me that what a higher priority is will be apparent from the face of the permits to be replaced and the permits that are granted. But that could be explained in a definition.
Because my sense of it is that you'll need to explain it so that people know what the effort is, that they are, and again it's a bit unclear, but they're presumably looking for a deem permit, and on the deem permit we'll have a list of folk or lower order priorities that the permit is, or high order priorities that the permit holder is subject to, something like that, and that then needs to be brought forward in the application for users' consent and translated onto a condition.
Yes.
And that's the sort of work that we're expecting to see. The planners do, and it'd be good to actually just grab somebody's consent and see it done in practice.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And it strikes me that that's always going to be a permit-by-permit process.
Yes.
They come in, you test what's on it, and what needs to be replicated and what's been surrendered or changed in the
meantime. And that's the uncertainties, isn't it? Because, you've got an old permit, a percentage of those priorities may no longer cease and not being replaced, so they fall by the wayside, and so what then gets left? And so that goes to the effectiveness, but I can't see a way around that unless you have a schedule, but the council says that itself will rapidly come out of date, probably for the same reason, because some of these things have been surrendered already or replaced by RMA consents.
Yes. Mm. I can understand why a schedule and a plan is conceptually attractive.
Well, even out of a plan, it's conceptually attractive.
Yes, but the difficulty with it is that all that the schedule does is aggregate together the information
which
that's on permits. And so it doesn't add anything to the sum of human knowledge. It simply keeps everything in the one place.
Is it conceivable that there will be an information gap somewhere such that you won't know or cannot know who the dominant or subservient permit holder is, to use the old language or the planner's language, is? Or will that always be, with a bit of digging, available somewhere?
Well, the short answer is I can't be certain about that, because all I have been able to do is to access permits that my clients have and observe the way in which the priorities are recorded on them. And it's variable about how it's recorded, but the fact is that they are recorded. Might it be the case that some permits don't record priorities on it? I simply don't know.
No, it's more in terms of working back what's been surrendered, what's been picked up by an RMA consent. So,
yes.
Again, it's actually having a complete record, a complete and reliable record for the consenting purposes going forward.
Yes. Well, it may well be the case that permits within the priority regime might have been surrendered or might have or simply never been exercised and are an historical artefact, and the person coming forward for replacement doesn't know. But the mischief there is minimal, because even if an obsolete priority arrangement is carried over, there's no reason to think that anyone's prejudiced by that.
Why?
Well, because if the permit either doesn't exist or can't be exercised, then that position will continue.
So then there's four things: surrendered, never exercised, but could be, can't be exercised, or is now an RMA permit, can't be exercised because you've moved your point of take.
Either that there's no water or that the infrastructure is entirely gone. There are water races and flumes and takes all around Otago that for 100 years have been not working. So, and all those will presumably come out on the wash on the 1st of October when nobody has applied to renew them. And so they will cease to exist anyway.
So could I just ask you a question about this 18th of March date? I've listened to you all talking about that point of entry being section 124, in terms of section 124, had to have your application in by 6 months if you want to be sure, 3 months if you want to rely on the council's kindness. And Mr. Welsh got up and said, well, they ought to have, you know, they had to be in by today or they're dead in the water. So I suppose my question to you, I know the planners had some kind of explanation of why they picked the date they did.
Yes.
I'm a little unclear as to the justification of that. My question might be, would something like yesterday's date be more in line with what you've also pointed out to me yesterday? You have to have put your application in to come within the framework PC 7.
Yes.
So that's my question to you.
Well,
and this is my question, it's not anybody else's.
I don't have a difficulty with the 18 March 2020 date being there. Frankly, I wonder whether there's a need for any date to be inserted, because it's a question of fact when somebody applies to replace a deemed permit, whether there was a right of priority on it or not.
I So this is something that the planners need to address, perhaps in a more fulsome way, as opposed to not at all. I don't think they addressed this 18th of March matter at all, because I had, of that I can recall, I had asked them the question, why 18th of March? Why not actually 30th of September? And I felt they gave me a sensible explanation back, why not 30th of September, a prospective date.
Yes.
And so I think this is important. Is a date needed? And if so, what date are they proposing? But why are they proposing a date? So I've latched on to the 18th of March because in my draft, because I actually thought I got a sensible explanation. So
yes.
Can we have... And again, it's the tyranny of shorter and shorter and briefer, JWS is coming in and,
yes.
And people going, I wonder what's on their mind. And of course, you might know, because you at least have an opportunity to talk to your witnesses. I don't until I actually get them on the stand. Yeah.
I haven't discussed the date issue.
No,
with Ms.
but
Dice.
I'm just putting it out there, and because Mr. De Polsmaker's at the back of the court, we need more explanation for recommendations coming through. Otherwise, we're just guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean, my view is that 18 March. 2020 would be a better date than the 30th of September for the reason that Mr. Brass gave when he was on the panel, because some permits might get replaced before then. So that's a better date if one's required. It's just not clear to me that any date's required.
Oh, well, planners are to think about the need for the date and what date and what's the date addressing. And
yes.
If no date, will that still be an effective mechanism?
Yes, because if we look at the wording of the policy on the screen, if it's simply read where the application is to replace a deemed permit, of course we all know that deemed permits are up prior to 1 October species, was subject to a right of priority, does the addition of the date add anything? From the point of view of a permit officer receiving an application and saying, what is the policy in relation to this permit?
So you and I are having a debate between ourselves, and I'm going, I wonder what the planners had in mind about the need for a date. Anyway, Mr. De Polsmaker has heard that. Yeah.
Okay.
So, again, just the general instruction. In terms of putting in the essential elements for a policy and a condition, those elements actually have to be explained. Because the court does not have access to the planning witnesses unless they're recalled and put on the stand. Yeah.
Yes. So can I come then to the way I've redrafted the reservation of control?
Yeah.
I detected a concern somewhere about, and I don't know who raised it or whether I'm imagining it, about if the matter of control was simply that the taking of water that had to cease when the downstream permit holder gives notice and there was nothing to anchor the reason why a notice might be given, that might be thought not to squarely address the allocation function of priorities.
Ms. King raised that.
And so what I've done is split the reservation of control with a conjunctive such that it is when the water passing is insufficient to supply and the notice has been given. So that so in my submission, that would overcome the concern raised by Ms. King. So those are my efforts, Mark.
Well, that's rather good. Okay, I have no problem with that. In principle, I think you probably need to define higher priority, maybe. You might need to, because they cease from 1 October, talk about replace a deemed permit. I mean, I know it should be self-evident, but it doesn't do any harm just referring back to Section 413, and that is all that is doing. So we know that it's that species of deemed permit, not coastal permits or something.
Oh, I see. Yes, no, I understand.
So it's that one.
Yes.
Yep. But it doesn't, I didn't think that, they didn't need to recraft that, they just need to say 413.
Yes, although of course Plan Change 7 only relates to taken use consents anyway. So,
Well, that's probably me being, because they planners recrafted it, I thought, so it's probably me taking a belt and braces approach, saying we don't need to do any more than what we need to do.
Yes.
Residual flow, you obviously don't see any difficulty with that. The court's given its guidance. We are not suggesting that you put a residual flow in a consent, and so you don't think, so that's our guidance. So we didn't want it kicked out because somebody said, oh, no, the court's wanting residual flows, so we don't want to, and that's not what, you know, the calculation of residual flows is not a... We're not expecting that, and we don't want our drafting to be kicked out for that reason. That would be to misinterpret it or misunderstand it, and then the question then became, should you be using residual flows? Although that's a term which is well understood. It means the flow past your door.
Yes, it's just that all those other matters do also refer to a residual flow.
Yes.
So we did have a bit of a debate about... Well, whether there may be some confusion as a consequence, because they're for very different purposes and they come about through very different circumstances.
Yes, and so that is why in the entry condition and the reservation of control, I've used the words water passing the point of take as opposed to the word residual flow.
Because, and I think that's correct, because that's all we're thinking about.
Yes, and I know certainly Mr. Hickey's advice to me is that amongst the hydrologists, a residual flow is a particular species of thing.
Which is why we flagged it.
So would you then work back up and put that in the new policy?
Yes, Commissioner, I think that would be the best.
I think that would help.
So you could perhaps just take out the word residual and just leave it at flow?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Right. So I don't think any of us have got any problems in principle with that. I think you're asking, can that go forward to the planners? Well, yes, and they can look at that and they can look at any other solutions that they might have in mind. Higher priority, I think, does need to be teased out.
Yes.
But that might be simply teased out by reference to back to Section 413, because you'll need to be looking at a permit. I don't know. I'll leave it for you and the planners, but certainly legal input is desirable at this stage.
Yes. Well, we'll work on that, and I'll discuss that with my friends to make sure that we're on the same page about that.
You got any problems, Mr. Moore, with part and tense?
No. I'm interested in Mr. Page's explanation in relation to removal of the notice requirement from the entry condition.
Yeah, that's... notice was actually important. It was important for the planners. It wasn't just that notice was also key for the council in terms of enforcement proceedings. I would have thought, have we given notice? We left that to be defined. It's probably notice in writing. And then the other thing that was really important for them was that you could only cease for 72 hours. And again, you know, we flagged, well, you know, maybe that 72 hours is important.
Yes.
I mean, it can be a rolling 72, but it's only 72. And so we flagged that in our copy.
Well, the reason for taking the notice out of the entry condition was simply because it relates to my submission that no vires issues arise from the giving of the notice. And so I conceptualised the giving of notice as being a machinery aspect of enforcement rather than something which had to be spelt out in the entry condition to overcome a vires problem.
You might need to think about that further.
But that was the thinking behind it anyway.
So you may need to think about that further and then come back to us, whichever way you land, with an explanation. Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
And the other thing... I won't pursue that.
Say again why you've taken or removed notice.
Well, I had understood that the way that the court had crafted the entry condition in its drafting was to ensure that the idea that a higher priority permit holder could give notice, didn't confront a vires barrier, if in the entry condition the permit holder had signed up to that. Now, my submission to the court is that there is no vires issue arising from the giving of notice, because it's the permit condition of the subservient permit holder that's being exercised, not the dominant permit holder.
You might be thinking that you might be assuming a lot, really, from my drafting at 7 o'clock yesterday morning in terms of all of the elements that I had in mind.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get into my own minutes now.
Yeah, I mean, there's merit and symmetry between the reservation of control and the entry condition. I had just conceptualised the giving of notice as being machinery rather than something that was required.
I can see. Okay. Well, that's something to think about. Whether there needs to be reference to the giving of notice, either in the entry condition or the reservation of control or discretion, or both.
Yes.
Anyway, things to think about.
Yes. Shall we come to Dr. Somerville's work?
If you wish. Yes. Oh, right.
Well, not really, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. With your drafting, what do you want us to do with that in terms of getting onto the record?
Well,
Have you got any formal submissions in relation to vires, or are you also adopting what Mr. Moore said?
No, I'm adopting what Mr. Moore said.
Okay, and so to get this on the record, does this need to be on the record? It's probably desirable because it's come in.
Well, I think it could simply be styled as a submission document on the vires issue and uploaded to the website on
okay.
that basis.
Okay, and so that's both versions or just the second version?
Just the second
definition?
One.
Okay,
just
so that's...
Would you want to take the word flow out on reflection in the policy? Take
the word residual flow?
Yeah.
Yes, well, if Rachel could make that change for me, I would be grateful.
All right, and so then we'll just upload that.
Just removing the word residual.
Yes.
Yeah.
Upload that to the as your submission dated.
I would support that, Your Honour, because residual flow is defined in the plan by reference to policy 647, and so it's not helpful to have that term here.
No, fair enough. Okay, so we'll just note that that is a sub submission to your. We note that as your submission on just a submission by Mr. Page. A single-page document. Okay, and that's with the word residual taken out, Rachel, and then we can upload it from there as a submission? Yeah. Okay. Very good.
Cool. Now, in relation to the Section 124 matter, I should record formally, so it's on the transcript, that it's ORUG submission that you need not decide it.
Yep.
I don't know that you need me to explain why, simply to record that that's the submission.
ORUG submits that the court need not decide the application of Section 124 to rights of priority.
Yes.
After 1 October. That's your submission?
That's my submission, done.
And that, I understand, is because... ORUG supports in principle policy and conditions being introduced into Plan Change 7, which is to have the same effect or similar effect to those expiring permits and their rights. Would that be correct?
No.
Because if there was nothing in Plan Change 7, then...
Yes. Well, so the submission, the reason why we say you don't need to decide it is because it is not necessary to address section 124 to determine the submissions that have been made, because it's really a neutral matter. Should Plan Change 7 proceed, it is ORUG's view, it supports what my friend Mr. Welsh said, that the prospect of having permits issued before the 1st of October is remote, and so it's an issue that will have to be confronted in any event, subject to an idea that I've just had that I'll share with the court. And if you reject Plan Change 7, it remains an issue that may need, and I say may, carefully, to be confronted in other ways.
The issue of?
Of do permits have the benefit, deemed permits have the benefit of Section 124. So thinking about it in those pragmatic terms, it's a neutral matter, it's a neutral factor either way, and so you don't need to deal with it.
Just pause there, sir.
Now, let me share the idea that I've just had with you.
Now, is this worthy of sharing? Is it a worked-up idea before we go down any rabbit holes? No, seriously, has it been thought through?
Yeah, no, I've been thinking about it for the last day or two.
Okay, good.
I haven't shared it with the court.
Yep.
And this addresses the situation where you decide that you do or should address the Section 124 issue in relation to whether the permits have the benefit of Section 124, not just priorities. And you find that Dr. Somerville is right. A workaround for that outcome would be to replicate Section 124 in Plan Change 7 itself as a permitted activity. That, and if there are jurisdiction issues that arise in relation to that, just as the court did in the Lindis case, Section 293 is your way forward.
Well, putting that aside, what 293 and how to get it there, if you like, in terms of scope aside, what did you have in mind? What did you have in mind? Could you just tease it out?
Yes.
What is the permitted activity? So if I have filed an application to replace my deemed permit...
Yes.
Okay, so that's it. I filed an application to replace my deemed permit. Then what? What is permitted?
Then, well, exactly as the Section 124 language proceeds, ma'am, you may continue to exercise that permit as a permitted activity subject to its existing conditions until that application has been determined.
So the possible implications of that are people are incentivised to keep delaying getting their permits decided, and this permitted activity may go on for quite some years.
Well, that is a risk that I think was raised with Mr. Moore earlier in the week about how Section 124 operates in any event. And so if Dr. Somerville is wrong and Section 124 applies, then the risk that that transition period between the application and the determination may take some time arises pursuant to the statute anyway. And so the risk is no different if the effect of Section 124 is replicated as a permitted activity within Plan Change 7. So again, Commissioner, my submission is that's a neutral factor, because if the risk of delay exists under 124, I'm not suggesting a mechanism that has any different function to what the Act provides for.
See if I can just puzzle out this in a decision tree. Hold on.
Because what I have in mind is that the language of 124 is used, which is that the permit can effectively be exercised on its terms until the replacement is determined. Yes. Implicit in that is provided the application was made prior to 1 April 2020.
Sorry, what date?
1 April 2021.
Okay.
So
only those people that got in the 6 months get covered by it?
Yes. Well, Section 124 contains a discretion
in the
subsequent
3 months. Yeah.
And so I'm envisaging the same machinery coming forward. But,
I mean, so that this is dealing with, if you like, if Dr. Somerville is right in relation to, and here the focus is on rights and priorities ceasing and that there being a gap between the 1 October date and the eventual replacement date, so that your submission is really addressing the gap, what happens in the gap, or to fill the gap.
Yes.
And to hold everybody true to their current arrangements and therefore true to the flows that are manifest as a consequence of that. Yeah.
Yes.
And when I asked the question, I was of both lawyers and Dr. Somerville, it's that gap.
Yes.
Not the whole thing, shooting match coming down, but it was that gap that I was particularly concerned about.
And the gap is either that the permits have the benefit of Section 124, but the priorities don't, or the gap is that neither the permits nor the priorities have the benefit of 124. But depending on how you decide that issue will depend on the scope of what you might consider as a workaround for the unfortunate outcomes of that.
And this is where you now need to give some thought to this, because you say the court does not need to decide the Section 124 issue, whether in relation to the whole permits, continuing to be exercised under 124, or just the rights priority exercised under 124. You don't need to decide that. What you need to decide is that there really is a need to have some replacement policy, and I think we're there and have been there for some time and have been looking for that policy. That then creates a gap and potentially a litigation risk, but it's not, in a sense, for the parties.
Yes.
Unless the parties are insisting that the court either make a decision and close it down as best you can, because somebody might take it somewhere else, or might take up a declaration somewhere else. So either the court make a decision or the court act conservatively to fill a perceived gap, which may or may not exist, depending if we don't make a decision. So, it's like I was quite happy not making more decisions than I need to and just leaving you with the litigation risk and not commenting on that.
Yes.
Because my best scenario was always that 124 applies to the rights of priorities.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and 124 applying to the rights of priorities and the deemed permits is the position that ORUG advocates for.
So you have to be clear, do you want us to make a decision and leave, or not make a decision? Because this is the litigation, there are risks.
Yes.
Yeah.
well, ORUG's position is that you shouldn't decide 124, but I'm conscious that that view is not shared by all the parties in this room. And so...
I thought nobody wanted me to make a decision.
I was more agnostic about it, Mark.
You're agnostic?
But that was discussion between Council.
I see. Okay.
Well, that just boils down to what I mentioned in court, that until that discussion that we had, I didn't see a litigation risk.
You didn't see a litigation risk?
No, yeah, not okay. really.
Well,
And if a party wishes... Say
it
if the court,
even be a party.
Say
it may not even be a party.
No, but say if somebody appeals a decision of the court that 124 does apply to the to the permit. And so I think if it applies to the permit, it has to apply to the priority as well, as I mentioned in my submissions. But if some person wants to appeal that, the policy will continue and the plan change will continue in the interim.
Well, it will, but there's just there will be a policy which folk can take advantage of sooner or later, just as soon as the court gets the decision out.
See, my cheeky submission, ma'am, would be if the court finds in favour of the party's position, then you should make a decision. If it doesn't, then it shouldn't.
Oh, but, you know, I
was going to sit down now.
Yeah, of course it would be, but and that has been, you know, we're thinking about that, whether to close it out. But we're also mindful if the court need not make a decision, then it should not. I mean, that's just good. Judicial behaviour, if you like.
And I think that was the earlier discussion.
And that was your earlier position. Yeah. And then I thought, well, then as long as y'all know what the risks are, that's, you know, we have done what we can. And so now we're looking at Mr. Page asking us to close out the risk. And so you can't have it all ways, make a decision, not make a decision, close out the risk, not close out the risk.
No, I think Mr. Page's submission has some appeal. To close out an issue if the court found in favour of Dr. Somerville's position.
Yeah, but then you require me to make a decision, which really you'd rather me not.
Well,
I
don't like being the only one that says to make a decision, but I'm not requesting the court to make a decision. I don't see the same downside in the court making a decision.
Oh, okay.
Because I think the parties have presented in my submission a fairly comprehensive response to Dr. Somerville.
Well,
but
you know that everybody can get to that at their closing submissions, what it is that they would like the court to do. But the court asked the questions because it wasn't assisted to understand the nature of the beast or creature that it was being asked to recreate the creature in the statute, or do something looking at an effect, if you like, of that, looking at rights as between abstractors. And because the court didn't understand the legal basis for the relief being pursued, the court has asked questions. Unfortunately, from some party's perspective, it's turned over a stone too many in asking those questions.
Perhaps if I just sit down on this point, Mum, from trespass perspective, it doesn't need new jurisprudence to be created near the end of the RMA. So what is important is that come 1 October, all permit holders are required to take active steps to stop their take. Because I did point out some of the practical consequences of that.
Yeah.
There still will be ongoing activities because these races will still discharge from collections along the way of inflows. But also, there is the potential for an irreversible effect in terms of the ecology, and that does exist, and I think that should weigh. But you have no evidence on that, but that could weigh on the court's determination in terms of an interpretive pragmatic solution.
Oh well, but everybody to think about their what they call whether they think the court should make a decision, and it is to make a decision on 124 and its application to deem permits in your closing submissions. It just needs to be a sentence. What do you want us to do?
Yeah, well, and that's tomorrow for me, ma'am, so I'll give it some more thought than I did over a coffee.
Over a coffee?
In terms of my comments to Mr. Page. So,
That's right. Okay. No, that's fine. Yes. Anyway, so that also applies to you, actually. Yes. You know, apart from the mechanism, how to get that in there, what is the mechanism?
Yeah.
How does that stand up?
Yes.
The,
all right.
The introducing the 124 mechanism.
Yes. Anyway, that's quite enough bright ideas for one morning.
Yeah, that's why I said, that's why I said, is this one thought through?
I do advance it in all seriousness.
Yeah, I know you do, because there is a, you know, from my point, I was only bothered about, not about so much the deemed permits, but was particularly bothered about the rights of priorities and then what.
Yes.
And in that, that gap, that of time between 1 October and anything,
yes.
You know, time for folk to get their decisions in on their consents.
Yes.
Mm.
All right. Can I then touch very briefly on Dr. Somerville's submissions? Because he...
I do want you to address savings or transitional, because there's some... In your original... In your submission, you seem to go, there's a savings provision... It's not transitional, and I wasn't sure why you said that, but then, but that might have informed your thinking and your planner's thinking on the relief that she proposed at the outset. So, what do you say? Is the section 413 a savings or a transitional provision?
My submission is that functionally it's transitional.
Functionally transitional. Yeah.
And I say that because of section 4137.
Mm.
And this is where I depart from Dr. Somerville's characterisation of ORUG's submission. Because he says that the implications of ORUG's submission is that the deemed permits may never cease. And my submission, that's not a correct understanding of what we're at least trying to say. And what I'm going to do is to track through the elements of section 413 that my submission are significant.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look to section 4131,
mm-hmm.
I support the submission that was made, I think, by Ms. Williams about the characterisation of the permits, the deemed permits in this case, that they are in fact water permits under 413C and thus are a resource consent as defined in the Act. Importantly, the words deemed permit have only very narrow application in the Act, and we see that from the last sentence of 4131. They are only called deemed permits for the purposes of this section and 414 to 417.
So deemed permits are only called deemed permits?
They're only called deemed permits for the sections 413 to 417. Everywhere else in the Act is blind to that status and they are simply water permits. The next element of the section is 4133, because this is where the expression finally expires is to be found. But the Act doesn't say that permits finally expire. Section 4133 says that the permits shall be deemed to include a condition to the effect that it finally expires. So 413 is simply a species of deemed condition, and so forms part of the permit.
Sorry, say that last part again. I'm just taking notes as you go.
Yeah.
So,
Section 413 yeah. deems the inclusion of a condition.
Yeah.
And it's the condition which says the permit finally expires.
Hmm.
So, by the time we've got to 4133, we have a water permit with a condition that says it expires on the 1st of October 2021. And so that is really no different to any water permit that contains an expiry condition. There's nothing different about that species of condition through the use of the word finally. So, having observed that we've got a water permit with a condition as to term, we can then move to section 417. So 413, I beg your pardon, subsection 7, and observe that the holder of a deemed permit, in order to replace that permit, may apply under Part 6. And that permit is the same permit that contains a deemed condition as to its final expiry. And as my friend Mr. Moore observed, Part 6 contains Section 124, which doesn't carve out deemed permits. So it's simply a matter of tracking in sequence through the sections to understand the nature of the right that Section 4137 gives to transition from a deemed permit to a permit granted under the Resource Management Act. And so Dr. Somerville is critical of the idea of reading words into Section 4133, saying that it's subject to Section 4137. My submission, it's not necessary to do that. In Dr. Somerville's submissions, he says that the effect of what O'Rourke's case does is to read into Section 413 the words subject to 4137. And he says that would be improper, and I agree with that, but that's not what we're doing. We're simply asking, what is the nature and the content of the permit that section 4137 refers to?
Sorry, what is the content
of the permit that section 4137 refers to? And it's simply the case that it contains a condition which specifies its expiry date.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that in my submission is the end of the matter. I want to say that section 124 doesn't preserve a permit.
Doesn't preserve?
No. So the permit expires on the date that the permit expires, as specified in the permit. What section 124 does is create a statutory right to carry out an activity on the terms of the expired permit. So, if Dr. Somerville is right that Parliament intended deemed permits to expire absolutely on the 1st of October, then section 124 isn't inconsistent with that, because the permits do expire. It's just that the Act provides a statutory right to carry out certain activities if there is a replacement application on foot. In every other respect, I adopt the submissions of my friends that have been presented, and right. So I don't need to say anything else.
Very good. All right. Thank you. Which brings us to Mr. De Palsmaker, who's just entered the room.
I call Mr. Palsmaker.
Carrying with him his briefs of evidence.
Oh, sorry.
Substantial.
I do.
Do you confirm that your full name is Tom Willie De Palsmaker?
Yes, it is.
And your qualifications and experience are set out in your statement of evidence in chief dated 7 December 2020?
Correct.
And you have prepared a statement of evidence in reply dated 25 June 2021?
Correct.
Are there any corrections that you wish to make to that statement?
Yes, there are some corrections I would like to make to the summary statement, as well as to the evidence in reply. With respect.
Pause on the summary statement. We will come to that after we've dealt with the the statement of evidence in reply.
Yeah.
So let's work through corrections to the evidence in reply first.
Yeah. There are a few minor typos, but the key ones, and this is not a typo, that I think is needs to be corrected is on paragraph 54 on page 24.
I have paragraph 54 on page 23.
Correct, yes. Ah. It goes on to the next page.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
So it's under drafting. A potential rule, I'll call it that potential, 10A31B, that goes on to the second page, page 24, and on the second line, under Roman 2, there is reference to condition B, and that should be condition Roman 2. And my apologies for that. That is because the drafting has gone through a number of iterations and over the last couple of weeks.
All right. So just pause there a second. So this is page 24 under Roman numerals 2, should read conditions Roman numerals 2, 5 and 7 of rule 10A3.1.1 and condition Roman numerals 2 of rule 10A3.1A.1.
That's correct.
Okay, got it.
And a similar or identical issue arises on page 32. Again, rule 10A.3.1B.1. And that is the sixth line up from the bottom of that rule under A, Roman 2 conditions. Roman 2, Roman 5, Roman 7 of rule 10A311 and condition B, and B should become Roman 2. In Appendix 5, Appendix 7, which is a Section 32AA analysis, in the table under Option 4.
Appendix 7, yep. In the table under
Option 4. So that's on the next page.
Yep.
Third column.
Yep.
Under the heading Community Water Scheme Operators, the first sentence can be crossed out.
Pause there a second.
Yep.
Oh, third column. Yep, got it.
So it is in the table under Option 4 in the third column. And there you have the heading Community Water Supply Scheme Operators. And the first sentence can be crossed out. The sentence starts with the words, the risk of stranding of assets is reduced. So that can be crossed out.
Subject to those corrections, do you confirm that your statement of evidence in reply dated 25 June 2021 is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Now, Mr. De Pelsmaker, you have also prepared a summary of the evidence set out in your statement of evidence in reply.
Do we need this in as much as I read this yesterday? This is my day off reading. So I don't know that we need another summary of this. You want a summary of this?
Well,
Yeah. Including in the middle of the night.
That's true, you see.
Because I was having trouble sleeping.
As I was. A couple of nights before, thinking about that.
Perhaps the only question I would put to Mr. De Pelsmaker, is there anything in the summary of your evidence and reply that picks up on any of the conferencing that occurred after you had filed your reply that you perhaps wish to highlight to the court prior to answering questions?
Well, obviously, the matter around rights of priority, we'll address that through further conferencing tomorrow.
Yep.
And possibly on Monday as well. And
yeah, I kind of read this subject to knowing that you had, you were going to go back into that.
And keep in mind as well, to provide explanation about why we are putting certain elements in there.
Yeah. Oh, no, that'll be excellent because, I don't have access to witnesses. So we're hearing it for the first time, and then I'll leave for the exercise of interpretation. And so, where you've got key elements, such as dates or words and phrases, really do need some explanation.
Yeah. Keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you confirm that the evidence you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do, yes.
You could please remain for questions from my friends and from the court.
Mr. Walsh, you were the first person to indicate that you had cross-examination.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ma'am.
The other day that I had questions for Mr. De Pelsmaker as well.
That's okay. Ms. Walsh got there first.
That's fine. I'm just clarifying that
you're
I'm...
You're second.
That's fine. Thank you.
No, we know that. And I did ask Mr. Cooper who else, and I think maybe ORUG and maybe TAs have also indicated subsequently, so that's fine. And Ms. Dixon, did you have any questions?
I don't think I do at the moment, Your Honour.
Okay.
I know I indicated the other day that I might want to.
We'll have you go and ask whilst you reflect on your friend's questions. Yeah. Okay, Mr. Walsh.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. Mr. De Pelsmaker, can I take you to paragraph 50 of your reply evidence, please? And at that paragraph, you identify that detailed technical information around the implications of Plan Change 7 on the operation of HEP schemes has been nearly exclusively provided by expert witnesses on behalf of Trustpower, correct?
Correct.
Yes. So you acknowledge, don't you, that Trustpower has provided detailed technical information on its schemes?
On certain aspects of its schemes, yes, correct.
And because of the evidence of Trustpower that it has given, you have a better understanding of Trustpower schemes in the Plan Change 7 context than hydro schemes generally, don't you?
Correct.
And it seems to me, Mr. De Pelsmaker, that a concern that's apparent in your evidence is that there's limited information about how Plan Change 7 may affect other hydro schemes or operators. Is that fair?
That is correct, yes.
And as a result, it's difficult for you to understand how Plan Change 7 may impact on other schemes and operators. That's correct too, isn't it?
If I do that, I would make assumptions.
Yes. So. And given that, if Plan Change 7 were to provide certain variety of words have been bandied around, carve-outs or exceptions that were limited to particular Trustpower assets or schemes, would this be less concerning to you than exemptions that applied to all hydro schemes generally?
Correct.
Now, if you could turn to your 32AA analysis in respect of hydro, I think that's appendix 4 or 5? Appendix 4.
407 last week.
Yes.
Find that.
Well, actually, my notes were correct. It's Appendix 5, so if you just turn one page, ma'am, where you're addressing Ms. Stiles' evidence. Apologies for that. Now, in your 32AA analysis in Appendix 5, you address the relief sought by Ms. Stiles' supplementary evidence, which, in summary form, proposed providing exceptions for hydro generally, don't you?
Correct.
And you say in your 32AA analysis that a cost risk of the approach of missile supplementary evidence, which you put in under option one, is that it allows for extended consent terms for new and existing takes for all HEG schemes, correct?
Correct.
And so limiting any PC7 duration exemptions to particular trust power schemes or assets would go some way towards addressing this concern of yours, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think, if I may expand on that, the nature of Plan Change 7 is that it's a process-driven or focused plan change, especially now in its current form. In absence of a framework that sets out what the outcomes are to be achieved, and in absence of a framework within Plan Change 7 to address environmental effects, the risk component becomes important, and it really comes down to trying to constrain that risk. And I think if in those kind of situations, identifying specific activities is a way of calculating the risk, it becomes a calculated risk rather than an unknown, because when I thought about Ms. Stiles' evidence, I could not foresee how many applications council might receive over the lifespan of Plan Change 7, and what the proposals themselves would entail in terms of impacts or the scale of the activities.
Okay, thank you. So in picking up on that, one response to that concern or that risk you've identified is limiting any PC7 duration exemptions to particular trust power schemes or assets that go towards addressing that risk.
It becomes easier to comprehend the risk.
Yes, yes, thank you. Now, I want to talk a wee bit around, or question you around, the MPSFM.
Yeah.
And draw your attention to that matter that may alleviate some of your other residual concerns. Now, are you aware that Council has recently amended its water plan to include several mandatory provisions from the MPSFM?
That is correct, yes.
Yes. Did so on, I think, 1 June?
Yes. It's in my evidence.
And one of these mandatory clauses is clause 3.241 rivers, isn't it?
That is correct.
And that provision that has been inserted into the water plan, in summary, requires the loss of river extent and values is avoided unless the council is satisfied that there is a functional need for the activity in that particular location, and the effects of the activity are managed by applying the effects management hierarchy, isn't it?
Correct.
And another clause inserted into the water plan, clause 2.2612, relates to fish passage, doesn't it?
Correct.
Yes. And those clauses inserted into the water plan are now operative, aren't they?
They are now, yes.
Yes. So do you agree that this means that when considering applications for water takes for new activities, the council will have to consider these new provisions in the water plan to the extent that they are relevant to those applications?
They have to, but obviously the ability to do so is constrained by the activity status as well. For example, if you come under the controlled activity status, you wouldn't be able to consider that matter.
Well, I'm talking about new applications still to be determined under the water plan.
So new activities.
New activities.
Yes. Yeah.
So yes. So my point is, for those new activities, which are captured by policy 10A 2.2 under the plan change 7, but for those new activities, it's fair to say that the regional planning framework, since we started this hearing, has now become more fit for purpose than when plan change 7 was notified, hasn't it?
Correct.
Correct. Now, I want to talk about your alternative relief, although I'm correct in saying that your opinion remains no change in respect of hydro, but you've provided, helpfully for the court and the parties, an alternative should the court be so minded as to adopt that, and that's what I want to talk about.
So what paragraph are we going to?
We're going to, I think it's... It's Mr. De Pelsmaker's 54, where he sets out that alternative approach.
Yeah.
You're aware that Trustpower's four deemed permit races are functionally connected to the wider Deep Stream and Waipuri hydroelectric power scheme, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes. And you're aware that the wider suite of Deep Stream and Waipuri consents all expire in 2038? That's been the evidence before the court.
Correct, yes.
And as part of your alternative relief, you've recommended, as an alternative, limiting Trustpower's deemed permit replacement consent durations to 2035, as opposed to 2038, when the rest of Waipuri and Deep Stream consent expires, correct?
Correct.
And you do that in order to set up what you suggest is an incentive for Trustpower to apply for its renewed full suite of Waipuri and Deep Stream consents about 3 years earlier than it might otherwise have done so.
Correct. The key reason for going back to a 2035 expiry date is because it goes back to the original version of the plan change, and the intent that where we provide some leeway for longer term consent durations, we would still try to make sure that they are considered within the lifespan of the new plan. The incentive is, I think, is a consideration as well.
And I suppose, Mr. Pelsmaker, I'll put to you another scenario rather than the one that you have suggested. Under the relief you've recommended would simply be for Trustpower to apply for the replacement of the deemed permit consents in 2035 when they expire, and then the remainder of Waipuri and Deep Stream consents in 2038. That's a possible outcome and a rational outcome too, isn't it?
It is a possible outcome.
Yes.
I think there are some efficiencies for Trustpower as well in bundling all those consents into one application, even if that means that they have to bring forward some of...
Yes. And those efficiencies Trustpower sought by...
Yeah.
Bundling in 2038. But if that scenario that I've just put to you did eventuate, then that would mean that we would not have an integrated management approach or assessment of the entirety of the Waipuri scheme.
That is correct, yes.
Now, can I take you to your paragraph 48, Mr. De Pelsmaker?
Yeah.
And you have provided the opinion that certain aspects of the HEG schemes that are currently authorised by the deemed permits appear to have significant impacts on the water source from a hydrological, ecological and a cultural perspective, and for your comments around those significant impacts, you provide citation to Mr Mitchell's evidence and Mr Moore's cross-examination of Mr Mitchell as recorded in the transcript, don't you?
Correct, yeah.
Mr DePaul's Mayor, I put to you that Mr Mitchell did not say in his evidence or in the parts of the transcript that you've referred to that Trustpower schemes are having significant impacts from a hydrological, ecological or cultural perspective.
No, that is correct. That is, he did not say it in those words. I simply reflected on what he said, and the key to that one, to that sentence, is also the word appear or may. It was a personal interpretation. One other consideration is, and that is not captured by what Mr. Mitchell was saying, is that from a cultural perspective as well, based on what I've, and I'm not a cultural expert, but based on what I've heard and what I've read, there are some inter-catchment transfers, which is a matter of concern, I believe, for Iwi. It is also something that is noted in the proposed new RPS as a resource management issue of significance.
Right.
So that's where I was coming from.
Yeah. So, Weeks, we've got to the point that Mr. Mitchell hasn't said what you've ascribed to him.
No.
And I've reviewed the transcript and searched on the Beaumont water race, which is the only race that takes water from the Clutha to the Tyree catchment. And what would you say, Mr. DePaulsmaker, that having done so, I can find no reference by any of the iwi witnesses to such, to the concern you've just raised?
So iwi don't talk about that specifically?
No.
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 No, the cultural matter arose when I was reading through the plan, the water plan, and the proposed RPS.
All right, so it's more your concern than Mr. Mitchell.
Yes, absolutely, yes. It's only, yeah.
Yes. All right, well, I'm not suggesting for one moment that there are such effects, but if there were, Mr. DePaulsmaker, would not Trustpower's relief of a longer-term consent being a discretionary activity mean that those issues, if they did arise, could be addressed by conditions or declining the consent?
That's a possibility, yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mum. I have no further questions.
Okie dokie. Ms. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honour. Mr. DePaulsmaker, I wonder if we can turn first to paragraph 70 of your evidence. And that's on page 34. And in that paragraph, if you just acknowledge that there has been evidence provided to this court that priorities are being exercised or are underpinning flow water sharing agreements that currently exist between permit holders.
That is correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I'd like to turn, please, to paragraph 83, which is on page 38.
Yes.
So prior to this paragraph, you've been discussing some issues and you've also been talking about the evidence which has been provided by Ms. King and Mr. Cummings.
Correct.
And so then you've got to a point in this paragraph where you've come up with a way to try and address those concerns.
It is something, and I'm conscious of the limited time that we've got, but
yes.
something that I thought at the time might be worthwhile exploring. My interpretation from Ms. King's and Mr. King's evidence is that there are implications not just for council, there are also implications for deemed permit holders. Basically, we're asking them to do a rollover for 6 years, which means that they're going to be tied to their existing infrastructure for the next 6 years, and then they can upgrade. But because of this rule, they have to put in telemetry, which is not cheap. Mm. I was a little bit concerned that, given all the extra obligations, that the approach would potentially kind of fail under its own weight. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at whether we could just simply constrain it to a number of areas where they are really needed. Yeah. I understand that this only addresses or only looks at priorities from an ecological point of view and the benefits it creates for ecological values. And I'm very mindful of the fact that there are other aspects to that as well, which is continued access to water.
One only looks at priorities in terms of its ecological values? Is
that no. This rule, this proposal would only look at the benefits it creates, incidental benefits it creates for ecological values, the way I propose to constrain it.
And that proposal being focus your efforts, if you like, in terms
where
of
galaxids are.
Priorities, where the galaxids are.
Yeah. And we've heard evidence as well that priorities do play a role. The issue that I'm playing with, and I think the court as well, is to what extent is the exercise of priorities now overtaken by agreements such as the False Dam Agreement? And is the continued existence of the False Dam Agreement reliant on the priorities being carried over? I was hoping that I was going to get an answer to that in the last couple of days, but that issue hasn't been discussed. Mm-hmm. And with that risk, they're still being there. I think carrying them over automatically as a default is probably the best way to go about it.
So just, and I'm going to ask you to put to one side, I know that we've had wording proposed by the court, and we've also had wording this morning proposed by ORUG, and I'm not actually asking you to think about that wording at this point. I did want to just perhaps run through the proposal in paragraph 83, because the way I understand your proposal in paragraph 83, which, as you say, is very much about an ecological effect, and it's actually a subset of all ecological effects because it is confined to galaxids.
Correct.
So the first matter which would need to be addressed is that there would need to be, as I read your paragraph, so it's catchments where priorities are being exercised. So in terms of an assessment of an application, the first point is not only is there an existence of priorities, but they're being exercised. So we've got 2 points there.
Correct. Yep.
The next condition essentially is that is also a catchment where galaxids are present.
Correct.
And then the third aspect is that there is an interface between the presence of the galaxids and the exercise of priorities.
Correct.
So you've actually suddenly, we've got at least three and potentially four, because if we say presence of priorities and exercise of priorities is two different things, we've got four matters now?
If I may, probably the first criterion is, if I would rewrite the sentence now, I would say where priorities exist on deemed permits. Yeah, and that is the exercise that we actually did or tried to do. It's not the wording. I should have worded it differently in that regard.
And I know you carry on to say in paragraph 85 and on from there that you've talked to another colleague within the council about how easy it would be to work out presence or likely presence of galaxids.
Yep.
And you certainly, and I would accept as well, that the information before court is not sufficient to determine that at the moment?
Especially in terms of where priorities are being exercised, I would agree. Where they exist on deemed permits, that is something that can be addressed by simply going manually through the deemed permits. We've done that exercise in part during expert conferencing.
Yes.
It would be a matter of days. It's a hurdle that you can overcome. And with regard to the galaxid populations, reflecting on what was said in court, I think there is a general understanding of the spatial distribution, the exact locations. There is a little bit of uncertainty around.
Absolutely, and in part that comes down to that galaxids are often remaining in smaller tributaries where the only ability to actually access those tributaries is with consent of landowners.
Yeah.
So there's just that constraint in terms of they might be, we actually don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So I also was then reflecting on actually objective 10A.1.1, and that's set out in Appendix 1. And I guess this is coming back to this purpose about facilitating an efficient and effective transition from the operative freshwater planning framework towards a new integrated regional planning framework. And the thrust of your evidence about this being a cost-effective and efficient process.
Correct.
For applicants.
Correct, yes.
And my concern, I guess, with trying to put a galaxid condition in is that actually that adds additional layers of complexity for processing and for applicants potentially, because is it the applicants that need to point to presence of galaxids or is it council that has to do it just becomes more cumbersome.
I totally agree with you in that regard. My concern, as I said before, is that the way with some of the drafting that was suggested or the amendments that were suggested on the proposed conditions, it was quite onerous for deemed permit holders to actually enforce them.
Yes.
And my concern was that, well, if that is the consequence of it, you might actually get the opposite effect, that people stop exercising them because of all the hurdles and the hoops they have to go through. So one of the outcomes that the plan change is trying to achieve is to avoid loss of further environmental degradation.
Mm.
So I agree with you, a more tailored approach is not as cost efficient in that regard, but I think there was that risk and that was where I was coming from. And I will also want to say about that was a suggestion at the time when the discussion was still ongoing, and I just wanted to keep it alive at that point.
And I understand that, so thank you for that explanation. There's just one additional matter that I wanted to flag with you, because the focus within or the way in which your conditions or preconditions, I'll put them that way, are framed in paragraph 83, it does term it to confine it to catchments. And of course we've had evidence actually from Ms. King, I think, the other day about there being cross catchment interrelationships between, I think it was the Roaring Meg catchment and the Lowburn catchment, if I have that right. So there's that complication. And the other thing which the court and you will have heard as well has heard evidence about is that actually often the infrastructure which is currently being used for the exercise of priorities is the more dated infrastructure. So we're talking border dike flooding, mm-hmm. and that actually also has an incidental environmental benefit because water then ends up in nearby but not mm-hmm. not connected water bodies which otherwise would yep. not. So there's a greater range of incidental environmental benefit from the exercise of priorities than just the galaxids.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Your Honour. I have nothing further.
And you're agreeing with Ms. Williams that there is a broader range of environmental benefit than just benefiting a galaxid through the exercise of those priorities, or?
Yeah, I would agree so.
Yeah.
The fact that water is there, just the presence of water is a value as well in many regards.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Ms. Irving.
I'm going to be asking you questions with two hats on. I'll start with an ORUG hat on, and then I'll put a territorial authority hat on. I'll let you know when I'm changing hats. I'd just like to start with your discussions on page 11 of your brief, please. And this related to a conversation or matter that was raised by Ms. Kate Scott around the possibility of phasing the replacement and the dates that might apply to renewed permits under Plan Change 7. At paragraph 26, you set out reasons why you think these concerns are perhaps not as severe as Ms. Scott articulated them. Mm-hmm. And at paragraph A, you take the view that replacement permits will have a range of expiry dates as they're processed under Plan Change 7.
A range of expiry dates, but also they will be issued on at different dates as well. So, yeah.
So when you say they'll be issued at different dates, you mean that their expiry date, by virtue of that, will be different or staggered? Understand that correctly? Now, would you agree that one of the concerns that has been expressed, and I think particularly by the likes of Ms. McIntyre, about the shortcomings of the current regional plan water framework is that it has failed to allow catchment-based or cumulative effects to be appropriately accounted for?
Correct.
Doesn't the approach or the outcome of issuing permits with expiry dates that are simply 6 years from their date of grant serve to repeat or exacerbate that same issue?
On the short term, I wouldn't say exacerbate, but you'll run in the same risk. But also, my response was to Ms. Scott's proposal, which I guess was, in her view, the consent expiry date should be further down the track. To me, there was a risk there that you wouldn't be able to consider those consents within a reasonable time frame to achieve the outcomes in the new land and water plan.
Yeah, I think from memory she talked about the possibility of staggering catchments.
Yeah.
Is there not an opportunity through Plan Change 7 if we were to take a staggered approach to the expiry of permits under Plan Change 7 to improve the potential effectiveness of or implementation of the land and water plan framework once it is operative? And I say that because you have an opportunity through Plan Change 7 to put a, say, common backstop on permits issued under it within the same catchments, allowing for more catchment-based management of those replacements under the land and water plan.
There is an opportunity, but I think I also noted in my evidence what Ms. Scott presented. It almost was like a theoretical model. I was not presented with any expiry dates for specific catchments, so I couldn't really judge it on that basis. Again, though, there is a risk if we do that now that there is a disconnect between the expiry date, the common expiry date that would be set in Plan Change 7, and then the time frame that is set in the new plan. So in an ideal world, you would have your time frames in your new land and water plan first and then determine the consent expiry date. I thought it was a really good idea, but I don't think that it fits well within this framework.
Do you think that the proposed regional policy statement might provide us with some signals about those sorts of timelines?
It does. I haven't had time to go through it in detail. It does set timelines, but those timelines are for the accomplishment or the achievement, of long-term visions. And a long-term vision to me is something when the whole picture needs to be complete. The risk that you have is that if you work towards the time frames for achieving the long-term visions, that you put everything on a back burner until then you work towards that date and that you actually kind of miss necessary steps along the way as well.
Do you think that is addressed, though, if the time frames that might be staggered all fall within the life of the land and water plan?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Do you think that issue is addressed so that the possibility of, I suppose, simply kicking the can down the road again, if the dates for staggering catchments under Plan Change 7 still fall within the life of the proposed land and water plan? So in essence, being no later than, preferably before 2035.
I think there's a bit of a risk in order to set... we haven't done the work to determine how long the transition of different bits of work will take. What I'm trying to say here... in order for those long-term visions to be achieved within the time frame set in the RPS, there might be a requirement to actually initiate certain aspects of that, certain land uses way before that. And at the moment, we cannot do that without the work being undertaken.
And I'm going to move on now to...
Now, it's 1 o'clock. Do you want to take a break? Unless you've got only a few questions to go.
I do have a few questions on the territorial authorities topic, so it perhaps is a convenient place to...
Yeah, so you're moving now to the TAs, are you?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, probably a convenient place to stop then. Yeah. So I'm just making a note of the last answer. Okay. All rise.